Sheila Chapman. I'm a student of Yaron Oz from Tel Aviv University. And I will talk about two papers that we did together with Yaron and another student, Igal Arav, and with Carlos Hoyos, who was a postdoc in Tel Aviv. So the first paper is about the trace anomalies in Lipschitz field theories. And the second one is about the hydrodynamics of superfluids, whose underlying theory is Lipschitz. So about the hydrodynamics, I'm not sure. Depends if we have enough time. Okay, so that's the outline of my talk. So I will start with the general review of Lipschitz field theory, tell you what Lipschitz field theories are about. Then I will say in which condensed matter system we can observe this kind of Lipschitz behavior. These are the strange metals. And talk a bit about field theory realization. So that's an introductory material. And then I will talk about the first project, which is about scale anomalies in Lipschitz field theory. I will give some review of scale anomalies in conformal relativistic field theories. And then I will talk about what we did in Lipschitz field theories. And if I have time, then I will talk about the hydrodynamics of normal fluids and superfluids of a Lipschitz field theory.
Just for the record, I want to say more interested in that last Lipschitz hydrodynamics. So,
okay, so I will
my vote counts.
I will try, but if I don't have time, then I will be really happy to discuss afterwards or keep on. Okay, so first, what are Lipschitz field theories? These are theories that have Lipschitz scaling symmetry. So this means that the time and space scale differently. They have an isotropy with the z, which is the dynamical critical exponent. So time goes to lambda to the z time, and the space coordinates go to lambda x. Okay, and since time and space behave differently, then this must be accompanied by broken boost invariants. For z equal to 1, when the symmetry is isotropic, this can be enhanced to the full conformal group. And for z equal 2, it can be enhanced to a conformal Galilean group. But in other cases, that's the whole symmetry we have. Now, this Lipschitz scaling shows up in condensed matter system close to quantum critical point. So let me tell you a bit about these condensed matter systems. So these systems are called strange metals. And the reason for that is that they have a strange metallic behavior. It means that their properties cannot be described within the standard Landau-Fermi liquid theory. And this includes high TC superconductors and heavy fermion compounds, which are metals where the effective excitations behave like heavy fermions. Now, this material seems to have a universal kind of behavior. For example, the resistivity is linear in the temperature, where in the Landau-Fermi liquid theory, it should be quadratic. And people believe that these kind of universal properties are due to this quantum criticality. So what you see in the picture is a phase diagram of one of these strange metals, one of these heavy fermion compounds. The vertical axis is the temperature, and the horizontal axis is the magnetic field. And if you look at zero temperature, when you tune the magnetic field, you have one point in which you pass a phase transition. This is called a quantum critical point. And you see that the strange metallic behavior is in the phase diagram in a whole V-shaped region above this quantum critical point. OK, so as I said, quantum critical point are zero temperature.
What does the color mean on the graph?
I'm sorry. So basically, the orange is the linear scaling of the resistivity with the temperature, and the blue is quadratic. So it's like the exponent between the resistivity and the temperature dependence. So orange is 1 and blue is 2.
This compound, does it refer to high TC superconductor, or does it refer to heavy fermion?
So this graph is a certain heavy fermion compound. It's just an example, but there are these kind of graphs also for. Of course, resistivity in high TC superconductors is above the superconducting regime, because in the superconducting regime, there's no point of talking about resistivity. But above the superconducting regime, you can see this kind of V-shaped region. And if you analytically continue, then you see that at zero temperature, you should have one point, which is the phase transition point. And you can also always play with some of the parameters. So you can have also magnetic field and doping, for example. So you can play with the magnetic field in such a way that the superconducting regime is much lower in temperature. So you can see how the graph continues as a function of another tuning parameter.
Regime here?
So this is not a superconductor, that's a heavy Fermi compound, but the region where the resistivity is linear in the temperature is the orange region.
Okay,
so as I said, these quantum critical points are zero temperature, normally second order phase transition that are induced by some tuning parameter, in this case the magnetic field. Now, since they are phase transition at zero temperature, they are driven by quantum fluctuation, as opposed to standard phase transition, which are driven by thermal fluctuations. And like any other second order phase transition, we expect that there is an infinite correlation length, and so we expect some scale invariance. And what people see is that this scale invariance is of the Lifshitz type, so there is an anisotropy between time and space. Okay, and then just one thing that I wanted to mention is that the influence of this quantum critical point is above the t equals zero, so it's not a theoretical t equals zero story, but it's felt way above in all this V-shaped region. Okay, so now let me talk a bit about the field theory of these theories. So first about the algebra. So the symmetries of Lifshitz field theories include time and space translations, which are the standard time and space translations. There is the scaling, which has a z weight to the time component, and then spatial rotation, because I said there is no boost invariance in these theories. And these are the commutation relations. The spatial moment has dimension of -1, and the frequency has dimension of -z. And it seems that from this algebra, we cannot build Casimir operators. So this is a very short exercise to check that it's not possible to build any Casimir operator, so P squared is no longer a Casimir, and the spin is no longer a Casimir. So it's not really clear what we mean when we say representation and do we have a spin statistics theorem. So this is just to point out that when you don't have boost invariance, a lot of the intuition that we have changes a lot. Yes.
So what do you mean by no Casimir operator? So you only consider quadratic operators that are quadratic in terms of generators. You didn't consider like high order polynomials of generators.
No. You can try to build whatever you want from these generators, but you need it to commute with all the other generators. Mm-hmm. And you cannot build anything that would be of this kind because of this, for example, the momentum squared or whatever combination you would get after trying to commute with the scaling operator, you would get some new z that appears in the p0 squared or whatever power of p0 you want to take. So it will not be.
But z is a free parameter here. So if you're saying for a generic value of z, there are no Casimir operators.
For standard, not one, for example, value of z, yes. Or two. So nevertheless, people write in the literature all sorts of field theory realizations of these models. So that's what you can find in the literature. So for example, people write this Lifshitz field theory with the free scalar, where the spatial derivative has to be scaled with the power of z compared to the temporal derivatives to have the right scaling dimensions. So for example, in 2 plus 1, z equal 2, you have this kind of Lagrangian density, which is the standard time derivative of the scalar, and minus Laplacian of the scalar to the power of 2. In this way, since time for z equal 2 has dimension of 2, then the derivative carry dimension of 4. It's the same for the spatial component. So you have to have different powers of momentum. And then you can do the same for fermions, for example. So the temporal component would be the same as it used to be in non-Lifshitz field theories. And for z equal 2, for example, you would have a spatial derivative squared instead of single spatial derivative. Now you can take this scalar and fermion and try to combine them to a Wes-Zumino-like supersymmetric model, and the supersymmetric transformation would be a bit different than in the standard Wes-Zumino model. And we are doing that right now, so we are trying to see what are the consequences of such a supersymmetric model. Okay, so now I move to the first, so that was just in introduction, and now I move to the first subject, which is the subject of trace anomalies in Lifshitz field theory. I start by some review of Weyl anomalies or scale anomalies in conformal field theory, which are not Lifshitz, and then I will go to what we did in Lifshitz field theory. So first, the world identities associated with scaling, isotropic scaling symmetry is the trace of the stress tensor should vanish. And then this identity can be modified by quantum anomalies for even dimensions. We can have contributions that are proportional to the Euler density and contributions that are proportional to various structures contracted from the Weyl tensor and its Weyl covariant derivatives. So these are the A-type anomaly, which is the Euler, and then the B-type anomaly, which are all the strictly Weyl invariant scalar densities. So in four dimensions, for example, we have the Euler, the four-dimensional Euler density, and the Weyl tensor squared, which is kind of a well-known result. And now the problem of writing all the allowed structure that can serve as quantum corrections to the trace anomaly is a cohomological problem. So it's not a trivial problem. And not everything that we can think of dimension of the stress tensor, dimension four, can be written here. And I will explain how this problem is addressed in the literature. So one thing I want to say before is that in 2 plus 4k, so that's 2, 6, 10 dimensions, there can also be a contribution to the trace from the Weyl partner of gravitational anomalies. So these are contributions that accompany gravitational anomaly in case the theory has any. So there could be additional contribution, but this would be a non-diffeomorphism invariant, so things that are proportional to the spin connection, for example, or the derivative of the spin connection and stuff like that. Okay, so keep that in mind. Good, so now I want to explain how to derive what are the allowed contributions to trace anomalies for conformal field theory. So basically, the allowed contributions must satisfy Wessel-Minow consistency conditions. This means that if the anomaly is derived from the action by a Weyl variation, and I put a little parameter sigma on the anomaly, which is the parameter of the Weyl variation, so basically it means that if I look at, for example, in four dimensions, the anomaly, I always consider it with the parameter of the variation, so that would be something of this kind. Okay, so the Euler density is like the anomaly density, but then that's the parameter of the variation of the action, and then all the measure and the integration stuff. So then if I take this anomaly with the parameter sigma 2 and vary it with respect to sigma 1, or the other way around, I should get the same thing. So this is just exchange of variation on the effective action. And then I need to check what are all the possible terms that satisfy this condition. When trivial terms are those that can be removed by local counter terms. So these don't count even if they satisfy the Wessel-Minow consistency conditions. And these are terms that are by themselves a variation of a local functional of the background field. Now, an alternative description is in terms of a BRST-like ghost, we can replace the transformation parameter by a Grassmannian ghost. And then the Wessel-Minow consistency condition would become basically the requirement that when we vary the anomaly with a certain ghost parameter xi, with a parameter xi, we should get zero. So the anti-symmetric nature of the ghost implements the Wessel-Minow consistency condition. So it's exactly the same, just we prefer this approach because it's easier to compute. And then the non-triviality condition is, again, that the anomaly should not be a Weyl variation of a local functional of the fields. Okay, so now So this is a cohomological problem. We are looking at co-cycles of the Weyl operator, that's the first condition on the left, which are not co-boundaries, so that are not a variation of local functionals. So these are terms that are closed, but not exact. And then one thing that I want to say is normally people do the relative cohomology with respect to diffeomorphism. So when people consider this structure, they only consider diffeomorphism invariant quantity. And if you consider things that are not diffeomorphism invariant, you can get this gravitational anomaly kind of contribution that I mentioned in the previous slide. Okay, so these are examples. In two dimensions, for example, the only term that we can put in the cohomology is the Ricci scalar. And there are no co-boundary terms, so that's the two-dimensional trace anomaly. In four dimensions, there are five possible expressions, the Ricci scalar squared, the Ricci tensor squared, the Riemann tensor squared, and then this R wedge R and box R. And only four combinations vanish under the operation of the Weyl operator, so satisfy the Wessel-Minow consistency conditions. These are the Weyl squared, the Euler 4, and then this Pontryagin term, which is the R wedge R. And box R also vanish under the action of the Weyl operator, but it is trivial. It can be removed by a local counter term to the action. So the two first are the standard, the parity even results that we see in the literature, and von Dreyagin also appears, but normally is not written there because the theories are parity preserving. Okay, so now I move to what we did. So what we did is to try and generalize this result for the case of Lifshitz field theories. In the case of Lifshitz field theories, the world identities associated with the scaling is not the trace of the stress tensor, but rather z times t00 plus tii equals to zero. So the time component gets away to z. And this can be modified by quantum anomalies. And we ask what are the most general corrections that are consistent with the Wessel-Minow consistency conditions. OK, so let me talk a bit about the geometric structures and what are the background field that we have in Lifshitz field theory. So since time scales differently than space, one has to consider the time direction separately by foliating space-time into equal time slices. When we consider the theory over a curved manifold, this structure generalizes the codimension 1 foliation defined over the manifold. So we have a vector pointing in the time direction. And this we call T alpha. So that's the foliation structure over the manifold can be locally encoded by a one form T alpha. And a vector would be in a certain time slice if it satisfies that T alpha V alpha equals to 0. And then if we want this to be to consistently define a codimension one foliation, it should satisfy the Frobenius condition. So then the background fields that we have for the Lifshitz constructions are no longer
just. What was the Frobenius condition? Okay, I see. This T should be hypersurface orthogonal. Is that the statement?
Yeah, that's the time. That's basically the time direction. So okay. Now you have the metric and the time direction because the time direction is special and you need something to represent it.
Right.
So these are the background fields. So there is the metric and the foliation one form, this T alpha. And we need to build things that are built from the two of them. Now, what replaces the diffeomorphism invariants in the conformal theories is now this what is called foliation preserving diffeomorphism invariants. And this is any diffeomorphism that preserves the foliation structure. So basically, this means that we should build invariants that from contracting the background fields in a covariant way. Okay, now the second relevant symmetry is this anisotropic vial. And you see that, okay, there are always two ways to look at it. You can either rescale the coordinates or rescale the metric. And what we do is rescale the metric. So the temporal component, that's the second line, scales with a factor of minus 2z. And the spatial component of the metric scales with a factor of 2 sigma. And then all the rest, so we assume that the foliation structure that does not rescale, that's like the coordinate. And we can always define a normalized foliation one form, and then it rescales according to the metric transformation law with a factor of z or minus z. Okay, PMU is the projector transverse to the foliation, and we are looking at the relative cohomology of the anisotropic vial operator with respect to this foliation preserving diffeomorphism. So we only look at expressions that are constructed from contractions of this T alpha and the metric and their covariant derivatives.
So it looks like you're able to couple this theory to a background metric in a vial invariant manner for any z. You said that the symmetry could only be extended to a full conformal symmetry for those two values of z.
Yes, you're right. So the symmetry is just the scaling symmetry. There's not a full conformal group there.
So why is there not a full conformal group? Because I could consider any transformation which leaves some flat background unchanged, and that should be a conformal symmetry.
So I think basically the thing is that normally when you add the special conformal transformation, then if you don't have boosts, then the algebra would not close. So you have a special time direction. The assumption is that you don't have the generator of boosts, so you cannot form a closed algebra with this.
I guess I can think of conformal transformations as a subset of diffeomorphisms plus vial that preserve some fixed background metric. So if I ask that same question here, shouldn't I get a conformal?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
So I can think of the global conformal transformations as a subset of diffeomorphisms plus vial transformations that leaves a flat metric fixed or some fixed metric fixed. So if I ask the same question here, could I should I not be in the conformal group?
I don't see how you would do that.
But you don't have a wide transformation here. I mean, you just have the.
She does, yeah.
You have an anisotropic vial.
Yeah,
it's not really.
Oh, you do have. Okay.
An anisotropic vial and.
So that's not really diffs, right? It's foliation preserving diffs. So it's not full diffeomorphism, but it's just diffeomorphisms that leave the foliation one form parallel to itself. So it's just this C mu of the diffeomorphism that leave.
Okay, so for Z equals 2, is the diffeomorphism group effect larger?
You could extend, but what we are considering is these cases that don't have the boost or the Galilean boost. So that's the structure that we are considering. You could also consider a kind of like full conformal extension. So just one thing is this world identities about in this Lipschitz field theory. So basically, if I have the TG, which is the stress tensor obtained by varying the action with respect to the metric, and TE, which is obtained by varying the action with respect to the field points, and then I can also define the current, which is associated with varying the action with respect to the foliation one form. Then the standard wild identity takes the following form, so those of foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. So the energy stress tensor is no longer exactly conserved, but there is a contribution from the current associated to the foliation one form. There is an antisymmetric part to the stress tensor because we don't have boost invariants. And the last one is the anisotropic scaling, which is basically T00, ZT00 plus TII equals to 0 in the curved space foliation vector notion. And then the two stress tensors are related. This is just the chain rule. Okay, so now we are trying to see what are.
Can you go back for a second? So is TG conserved or not?
No, both of them are not conserved.
Neither of them are conserved.
Neither, sorry.
I see. Neither of them.
So as I said, I go back to our problem, which is to build all the possible scale anomalies in Lipschitz field theories. And it turns out that all these anomalies can be built from the following basic tangent tensors. So that's the intrinsic metric, which is the projector, the acceleration, which is the lead derivative of the foliation one form in the direction of the foliation one form, the extrinsic curvature, the intrinsic Riemann curvature, the lead derivative of the foliation in the direction of the foliation one form of any of the above tensor, which plays the role of a temporal derivative, the spatial or foliation projected covariant derivative, which plays the role of a spatial derivative, and then the intrinsic Levi-Civita tensor. It's possible to prove that all the structure can be constructed by contracting the indices of this tensor in all possible ways. And these are the naive scaling dimensions. So the intrinsic metric has dimension 2. Upper metric has dimension minus 2. The foliation one form has dimension z. That's the time. The Riemann tensor has dimension 2. And these are the dimension of all the other tensors. So what one has to do now is to build all the possible scalar by contracting these tensors that has the right total scaling dimension. Now, since the integral have an integral over time and d space dimension, so the total dimension of the quantity that we build should be d plus z, d for the space and z for 1 dt time. So then what it means is that in general, the number of time dimension times z, because every time derivative scales with z, plus the number of space derivatives should be d plus z. That's just dimensions at global scaling consistency. And then if we want the indexes to be possible to be contracted, we need that the number of space dimensions plus the number of indexes in the Levi-Civita tensor be even. So that's another condition. And then the number of time derivatives in terms of our tensors is just the number of lead derivatives plus the number of extrinsic curvatures. And the number of space derivatives is the number of foliation projected derivatives plus the number of acceleration and plus twice the number of the Riemann curvature. Okay, so one thing about the classification, I mentioned already that there are type B and type A anomalies. So type B are strictly Weyl-invariant scalar densities, and type A are all the rest. In the case of conformal symmetry, this is the Euler density. Now, for conformal symmetries, the A type are if and only if they are total derivative or a topological invariant. But for Lipschitz theory, this is not true, so we just use the first classification, which is more precise. And these are our results. So in 1 plus 1 dimension, for z equal to 1, these are the possible terms that one can build. You have the cocycles in the box, so there are two in the parity even and two in the parity odd sector. And then turns out that all of them are co-boundary, co-boundaries. So there is only one anomaly in the parity odd sector. And we did this analysis for z integer from 1 to 12, and we get exactly the same one anomaly for all z up to 12 for 1 plus 1 dimension. We have an assumption that this might be the case. Okay, maybe we will be surprised. Maybe at 13 will not be. But so we haven't managed to prove that. In 2 and 3 dimensions, we did quite a large analysis of a lot of different z's. And we found a lot of results. So in 2 plus 1 dimension, one thing that is interesting is that you have anomalies. So in conformal case, you don't have anomalies in 2 plus 1 because you cannot build anything. But now you have this foliation 1 form and you can build things. So it turns out that there are anomalies in 2 plus 1. One of these results has been found already in the literature is the 2 plus 1 z equal to 2. We compared our results and we get exactly the same. And then we did also z equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, and some non-integer values of z. And then in 3 plus 1 dimensions, as you can see, there are many more anomalies than what you can see in the conformal case. For example, for 3 plus 1, z equal to 1, there are 12 anomalies. For z equal to 3, there are 7 anomalies. And I wrote some of the structure, but some of them are really long, so I couldn't write everything. And we found one general structure. So the structure that you can see on the bottom of the slide would be an anomaly for any d and any z, bigger than 1.
Maybe not. So the type A ones, you said they weren't topological invariants?
If you think about it, even in the conformal theories, that in the parity odd sector, that's no longer true. Because you have this Pontryagin, right, which was R wedge R.
So that's
exactly, but it's also a Weyl-invariant, strictly Weyl-invariant density. So this kind of saying that type A, if and only if it's a total derivative, is no longer true even in the parity. So it's very similar in Lipschitz. So we needed something well defined.
Is it true that type A is always measuring something topological?
So we didn't find any type A. So I'm going to say something about that. But all the anomalies that we found are type B, and that's quite a lot of examples. So we don't know. Maybe that's a general thing. Okay, so this is just to give an idea of the complexity of the calculation. So for some examples, in 3 plus 1, z equal to 1. So these are some of the anomalies, some of the 12 anomalies that we found. So of course, in this case, there are 87 FPD invariant quantities, and you need to find all the combinations that vanish under the action of the Weyl operator, so that's not trivial. And for the three dimension, we had to use Mathematica to do that computation. Okay, so now some words about comparing this to the conformal case. So any conformal field theory can be regarded as a Lipschitz field theory that does not depend on the foliation. So basically, just add the foliation, and the action would be independent of the foliation. With z equal to 1, because this in conformal field theory, there's isotropic scaling. Now, any diffeomorphism invariant term that may appear in the conformal cohomology may also appear in the Lipschitz one, because anything that is fully diff invariant is also foliation preserving diff invariant. But the opposite is not true. So, for example, in two dimensions, in 1 plus 1, in the conformal cohomology, we have the Riemann. The Ricci scalar, it's possible to use the Gauss-Kodaty equation to write it in foliation terms as the following combination. And this term that used to be an anomaly in the conformal case is no longer an anomaly. And the reason is that we have more counter terms now that we can add to the action, because we allow to add to the action things that are not fully diff invariant, but are just foliation preserving diff invariant. And you see this term k squared minus a squared, for example. So if we add this, we can get rid of this Ricci scalar. And so it's no longer an anomaly. So both in 1 plus 1 and in 3 plus 1, the Euler density becomes a cobound term. That's what we found. And we also found that all the anomalies in all the cases are B-type. So they are strictly Weyl invariant. So we don't know how to prove or to explain this, but this is something that we found.
Do you know that all the anomalies you found are independent from each other if I use Gauss-Kadachi to try to...
Yeah, of course. We used all the possible identities. Actually, you can, if you do, it's a nice calculation because you have a check on this calculation because you need that all the coboundaries are all co-cycles. So anything that is, because it's defined with the Grassmannian. So if something is exact, it must be closed. So this check, if you do this check, then a lot of times if you didn't take into account identities, it just pops out because things are not consistent. But we took into account, hopefully, all the identities. And also dimensionally dependent identities, so everything that comes from anti-symmetrizing more than the number of indexes. And, okay, so one last thing is the relation to 1 plus 1 dimensional gravitational anomaly. So one more thing that we found is that the single anomaly that we do have, which is parity breaking, is related to this Weyl partner of gravitational anomalies in conformal field theories. So in 1 plus 1 conformal theories, we can always shift the gravitational anomaly to a pure Lorentz anomaly. And this means that the effective action would depend separately on the field bind with the 0 upper index and the field bind with the 1 upper index when the mu indexes are fully contracted. So it's diff invariant, but not locally Lorentz invariant. And then the anomalous world identity that corresponds to this Lorentz anomaly would be what's written there. And as you can see, the trace gets another contribution from the derivative of the spin connection in a theory that has gravitational anomalies. So now, if we take this theory and we redefine it to be a Lifshitz theory, so we somehow put a foliation dependence there. And the way to do that is to take the conformal action and replace the emu 0 with emu a and a, and the emu 1 with emu a, epsilon a, b, and b. So this is a definition that on a flat foliation, when n equals to 1 and 0, reduces to the conformal definition. Then if we do this kind of rotation, add defoliation this way to the structure, and we look at the contribution of the gravitational anomaly to the trace identity, then what we get is exactly the up to coboundary terms, exactly the parity odd anomaly that we found in Lifshitz. So it's just an interesting observation. Okay, so that's basically what we have as general conclusions and open problems. So first, we found that all the anomalies are B-type. Is this always the case? Can we prove that this is always the case? Can we prove that for 1 plus 1 dimensions, for any Z, the form of the anomaly is what we found, the single anomaly? Can we find a general structure for anomalies in other dimensions? Can we prove kind of monotonicity theorems on the coefficients of these anomalies? So I know there is a cultural saying that that this kind of CA theorems can only be proven on the coefficients of A-type anomalies, but I don't know exactly the rigorous statement behind it. So if anyone knows, then I would be really happy to hear. And then can we compute these the coefficients of our anomaly in field theoretical or holographic models? And can we relate these anomalies to the logarithmic term of entanglement entropy in Lifshitz field theories? So that's a list of open questions. So that's the first subject. That's the first work that I wanted to talk about.
Can I ask a question? What is the significance of these anomalies? You start by talking about this, this kind of smatter system. So if I have these anomalies, how does it help? Does it help in constructing the action for those systems? What can I do with this?
So the same way that anomalies in conformal field theories are related to correlation functions of stress tensors.
Mm-hmm.
Also here they are related to correlation function of stress tensors. So I don't know exactly what they can measure, but I think what they measure is in fact correlation functions. So this can say something about correlation functions.
So how does the correlation of the stress tensors depend on these anomalies?
So basically the trace of,
uh-huh.
So normally in trace anomalies, you would get T mu mu T alpha beta, say in two dimensions, maybe more values of T, by differentiating what you get from the anomaly. Is not zero, is this, I don't know, C or A. So in our case, instead of T mu mu, you would have T 0, 0 plus D, ZT 0, 0 plus TII times T alpha beta times whatever is different than 0, and this you could measure. But this gives you information about these correlation functions.
Nice. So if all the anomalies are B-type, there's no non-trivial Wessimino terms that you can write down?
Yes, it seems, but... okay, but the stats only study for 1 plus 1 certain values, 2 plus 1 certain values, and maybe, I don't know. Okay, yeah, so we have a lot of things to continue to do. Okay, so that was all the story about the anomalies in Lifshitz field theories, about trace anomalies. Now, the second thing is about the hydrodynamics of Lifshitz field theories. So, like any ordinary material or material near a critical point, also quantum critical system can have a hydrodynamics description, and this is under the following condition. So, this is if the typical length scale of the system or of derivatives in the system is much smaller than the correlation length of quantum fluctuations, so that we are in the quantum critical regime, and much bigger than the length scale related to the temperature or mean free path, so that we can average and get hydrodynamics. So under these two conditions, we have a hydrodynamic regime. Now, the hydrodynamic description that we write should take into account these effects due to the lack of boost invariance in Lifshitz field theories. Now, since boost invariance is explicitly broken, the conserved stress tensor is not necessarily symmetric. So the way to see that normally the stress tensor is symmetric is to write the current of Lorentz transformation, and we see that the divergence is related to the anti-symmetric part of the stress tensor. So if the theory is Lorentz invariant, then the energy momentum tensor would be symmetric, but if boost or rotational symmetries are broken, then this condition can be relaxed, and we can have an anti-symmetric contribution to the stress tensor. Now, so that's what we do. We allow for an anti-symmetric contribution to the stress tensor, and since only boost invariance is broken, this contribution would be in the direction of the normal, in the direction of, in the time direction. Now, if we assume that boost invariance is broken in the rest frame of the normal fluid, then the thing that points in the time direction is the normal fluid velocity, and then the anti-symmetric contribution to the stress tensor would be the anti-symmetrization of this normal fluid velocity and some terms that we need to find. And then if we want from field theory to see this anti-symmetric term, we need to construct the stress tensor as a response of the action to a change in the field binds.
So, may I ask a question? I don't understand. For example, if you consider just general action, I don't know, Lorentz invariant, for example, and you, for example, apply Noether theorem to it, you don't necessarily get a symmetric stress tensor.
So, can you give an example of what you're thinking? You can always improve, right? You can always improve the stress tensor in a way that it is symmetric. So you can always add kind of counter terms that would make it symmetric. But in these theories, it seems that you cannot make it symmetric in any way.
If you don't use the Feuerbein, if you start to couple to the spatial metric and the foliation parameter, why is that not,
automatically
symmetric?
Because the foliation parameter also has a Feuerbein dependence. So normally you could, if it only depends on the metric, then you would have this dependence of mu a and ua, and you can always relate the two. But if you also have the foliation dependence, then you remember the TE, the one derived from the field binds, you can show by simple chain rule that it's related to the one derived by the metric, which is symmetric, plus the foliation one from this J mu, and then T nu, which is the vector of the foliation. So in this case...
I can imagine working in ADM variables where I have a spatial metric, a lapse, and a shift. then everything looks symmetric.
I'm trying to think.
But you can define it as stress tensor is symmetric, it's just not conserved. But I guess that's, this guy is conserved, or isn't it conserved?
This guy is conserved.
Okay, so it's different from the other one that you might define from the metric.
Sorry, may I also ask, so for example, if we consider stress tensor as a variation of the action with respect to metric, so does it mean that we can't write metric in the full space, we can write it only on some fixed time slice, for example? Does it mean, so does it, do I want to say that we can write metric only on a fixed time slice, like, of the space?
Why would you be able only to write the metric? I don't understand, again.
Okay. For example, okay, we consider that stress tensor is a variation of action with respect to metric, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And metric is always symmetric, okay?
Okay.
So that works only for a different variant theory. If it's not a different variant theory, then I mean, you can define that, but I mean, that doesn't make any sense. There's no point to it. It's not a different variant. So
I'm asking, does it mean that we can't introduce general metric in the whole space?
I'm sorry, what's the question? You're saying you cannot do that, or you can?
That's what I'm asking.
I didn't fully understand the question, but maybe we can, like,
okay,
after, ask me after, okay, and I will think. So good. So now the conservation of the energy stress tensor determines the hydrodynamic equations. The hydrodynamic variables are the four velocity, u mu, the temperature T, and for a charged fluid there is also the chemical potential, and for a superfluid there is also a superfluid velocity, which is independent variable. Now the new antisymmetric term should be compatible with the laws of thermodynamics, in particular with the local version of the second law, so local entropy increase. Now, we present the correction to the stress tensor up to first order in the derivative expansion, and these results are universal up to the value of the coefficient in the hydrodynamic expansion, which depends on the details of the theory or the quantum critical point. So we want to see what is the form of the stress tensor, and the conductivity we leave unfixed depends on the theory. So in the neutral fluid, a neutral Lifshitz fluid, there is a single new transport coefficient allowed by the absence of boost invariance, and the effect of this coefficient is the production of dissipation when the fluid accelerates. So that's the contribution proportional to the acceleration of the fluid, and it creates heat when the fluid accelerates. Now, in the case of superfluids, we have two velocities. So there is the velocity of the condensate, and there is the velocity of the normal component of the fluid. So we denote by u mu the normal fluid for velocity, and by xi mu the gradient of the Goldstone phase, which points in the direction of the superfluid velocity. In non-relativistic limit, we have this velocity, we denote them by vn and vs. N is for the normal, and s is for the superfluid part. And the counterflow is just the difference between them. And for superconductors, there is a broken gauge symmetry, so there is an addition of gauge field to this gradient of the Goldstone phase. Now, the constitutive relations are the following. So in the stress tensor, there is a zero-order part, which is of due to the normal fluid, a zero-order part due to the superfluid velocity, and then dissipative correction, so things that come at first order in the derivatives. The symmetric part contains this q mu, which is the heat flow, and the antisymmetric part contains this va mu, which is the vector characterizing the antisymmetric part. And we want to determine these corrections that are consistent with the local requirement of local entropy production rate.
So which ones are dissipative here and which ones are not?
So all the pi is,
okay.
You see the stress tensor, the epsilon plus p u mu u nu plus p eta mu nu is the normal fluid zeroth order.
Mm-hmm.
The F zeta mu zeta nu, so F is basically the charge density of the superfluid part. That's the superfluid zero order, and then pi mu nu symmetric is the symmetric first order or whatever dissipative contribution, and antisymmetric pi mu nu is the first order antisymmetric part. And so then this is just the decomposition in the frame that we choose.
Is there a zeroth order anti-symmetric part or not?
No, so we show that this is not consistent with the second law. You cannot do any add. So only one thing you can think of adding, right, at zeroth order is just this u, mu, zeta, nu. That's the only thing, so normal and superfluid anti-symmetric. That's the only thing that you can add. And you can show that this contribution is not consistent with the second law. You cannot have positive entropy production rate if you add this term at zeroth order.
That's surprising.
Okay, and then these are the equations of motion in the non-relativistic limit. So there is a mass conservation, there is the Navier-Stokes equation and the energy conservation that has the heat flow in it and the corrections to the heat flow, that's Q tag. And this is what we find. For the superfluid, we found a four characteristic contribution to the heat flow. Two of them are proportional to gradients of the temperature, so that's standard, that you have a heat flow in the direction of temperature gradients. There is an anisotropy between the direction of the superfluid velocity and the direction perpendicular. That's also standard in superfluids. And then there are these new transport coefficients that are due to the Lifshitz or the broken boost invariants, which are proportional to the normal fluid acceleration and are also anisotropic between the superflow direction and the perpendicular direction. So that's just the dimensions of the coefficients. So basically what we see is that there is a part of the heat flow which is proportional to the acceleration of the normal fluid component, which is anisotropic between the direction of the superfluid velocity or counterflow and the transverse direction. The effect of this new coefficients are hard to disentangle from the effects of shear viscosity, and the reason is that it's very hard to accelerate a fluid in a uniform way without creating shear effects, because normally to accelerate a fluid, you drag it with the walls, and then you have also shear effects, and the effects are very similar. So it's hard to disentangle, but if you have two independent experiments, maybe you can determine these two coefficients. Now, in superconductors, there is a very similar effect, but you need to accelerate the normal part of the superconducting current. So that's very hard, and you can do it maybe by alternating a current that normally also creates a flow of the normal component. Okay, so then perhaps some unusual frequency dependence could reveal the effect in superconductors. So that's the open question. So first is suggest a measurement for superconductors. Then we would like to include parity violating effects, because what we did not include parity violating effects. And perhaps construct holographic models, because there are holographic models for Lifshitz fluids and holographic models for superfluids, but not for the both of them. So that's an open question. And that's it.
Michelle? I have a very naive question. So you mentioned that when you have normal liquid, there is a dissipation due to acceleration. Is that true?
In normal Lifshitz fluid, you mean?
Yes.
And not superfluid, yes.
Do you mean that if I have my material and I put inside a free-falling attenuator, then depending on which reference frame I choose, I'll see, so for instance, why in a lab frame, then I'll see heating, and if I'm standing inside the attenuator, I don't see any heating?
So I think I need to think about that.
There is a preferred frame. So this is, here, I guess the idea is that here we have two fluids and there's a relative velocity between them.
But here I have only normal liquid fluid, right? So there's only one component.
If you have one fluid, then you don't have a Lifshitz theory. Because you need to have something that sets the reference frame for you. So I guess in this case, you have these two types of fluids. I guess there's the superfluid and then the regular fluid. And it's the one sets a reference frame for the other. I'm not quite sure which one for which. But I mean, if you just have one, then you have a Lorentz invariant theory.
So basically the work, if you talk about superconductors and then you have the material that you lie inside, all right, so you accelerate with respect to it. The work on the normal fluids is a work that Yaron did with Carlos and with another Korean postdoc, Bom-Soo Kim. And I'm not sure, I need to think about that, but I can just give it a little thought. I'm sure it has a simple answer, and I will get back to you.
I guess I just have a comment. I find it very surprising that you said, I mean, at zero third, that anti-symmetric part should vanish for the media, because I think that might lead to some weird effects. But then we can talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So, this I can show you the explicit calculation. And so
it's probably depend on the specific way you define the entropy curve, right?
Yes, but you can show that you cannot add anything. So the what we checked is that you cannot redefine neither the entropy current, the entropy density, any of the hydrodynamic variables. You cannot redefine them in such a way that this gives. So at zeroth order, this should give zero entropy production rate. So there is no redefinition that you can do to the entropy current at zeroth order. For example, you could think maybe the entropy current, now is not. It's not SU mu, but it's SU mu plus some coefficients time zeta mu or something of that kind. And this does not fix, it cannot cancel this, the contribution of an anti-symmetric part. And this you can show explicitly.
Yeah, but I'm just pointing that's a little bit, it's not the triggers, right? So we know examples where later on, a posteriori, once we discovered the extra transfer coefficients, we went back and we found a way how to redefine the entropy current.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I can go through.
I guess the simple exercise that, you could do this, exercise, I guess you could just, the same way that you calculate T mu nu for a collection of particles, like a gas, a thermal gas. You could do this for thermal gas of Lipschitz particles. And then you find that it's anti-symmetric. So. It's not symmetric. It's not an anti-symmetric. There is an anti-symmetric part to it. And I don't know what. So maybe somehow what you do for a regular gas cannot be done for a Lipschitz gas and particles. But I mean, that's. I thought that's crucial to have that, to get, say, the right speed of sound for the. Anyway, but these are some calculations that if you want to get the right speed of sound, you need to have this anti-symmetric part.
Maybe you can
absolutely.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks.